Thank you for downloading this podcast of Jeff Hill discussing leisure and politics in Northwest England, recorded at the British Society of Sports History Northwest Workshop in November 2012.
I'm going to do something fairly straightforward and I suppose rather descriptive, really, and quite informal. I want to explain a piece of research that I'm doing at the moment, and which is completely unfinished. I have written up a draft of it, but it's very prototypical, if that's the right word. And there are lots of gaps in it. And what I'm really hoping out of this session is that you'll give me some great ideas, I'm sure you will, of where to go with it. I'm not absolutely sure I know how to do it, to be honest. And what I'm trying to do is to bring together two areas, two fairly separate areas of research that I've been involved in over the years. One is sport and leisure, which I've been working on in recent years. And the other is politics, which I was just saying to Dave, I did a lot of work on in the earlier part of my career and then rather dropped it. But I'm trying to kind of merge the two in this research. It's not about the politics of sport. It's not that sort of sport and politics. I mean, we've had a lot of stuff on that, often from people at Loughborough and so forth. This is more to do with the kind of role that sport and leisure activities might play in the building of political culture, if I can call it that. I've stopped using that word culture a lot these days, because it's overused and it's kind of lost its meaning. Political mentalities, perhaps, will be a better way of describing what I'm trying to get at through the angle of sport and leisure. I don't suppose any of you will have looked at or even remember a famous old book by a French sociologist called André Siegfried, who just before the First World War, in 1913 actually, produced a book which looked at why in Western France, despite fluctuating economic and political circumstances, a lot of people always voted the same way in Third Republic elections. And he said, you know, it's because they have a kind of ingrained mentality. Issues don't affect them all that much. It's loyalties that they're expressing, identities, when they engage in politics. And John Vincent, a more recent and famous writer on British politics, summed this mentality up very well when he said that when you're looking at elections, it's not what people vote for that you should be concerned with, not entirely anyway. It's not what they vote for. It's who they vote with that might hold the key to understanding it. So that's one of my guiding themes. And what's triggered this piece of research is something that I looked at in the earlier part of my career quite a lot and want to go back to, and it's the role of the Conservative Party in Northwest England over the course of the 19th and the 20th centuries, where, although Lancashire and the North West, as Mike has amply demonstrated, you know, we have an industrial society, and in most of the parts of the country in the 19th and 20th centuries, those kinds of regions like the North East, coal mining districts and so forth, South Wales, voted Liberal. The Liberal Party was seen to be the party of modernity and the popular masses and so forth. Lancashire didn't follow that path. It had a very strong tradition of conservatism, particularly popular working man's conservatism. And this was clearly evident after the vote was extended in 1884, following the Third Reform Act. Many of the industrial constituencies in Lancashire returned conservative MPs. There was, to some extent, a sort of geographical distribution of this. It tended to be more common in the western parts of the county, around some of the coal mining districts of Wigan, St. Helens, places like Warrington, and particularly Liverpool, which had a really dynamic working man's conservative association headed by the brewer Archibald Salvage. Liverpool, therefore, the paradigm, if that's the right word, of this pre-1914 conservatism. How do we explain it? How have historians explained it? Well, to some extent, according to issues that come and go, issues unfavourable to the Liberal Party, like Home Rule or the Boer War and imperialism generally, but more the kind of political mentalities that were embedded in some of the communities, particularly in Western Lancashire, which seem to have bred, and the immigration of Irish people is important here, seem to have bred a marked hostility on the part of indigenous workers to Catholicism and Irishness. And the best way of putting that viewpoint forward in politics was to support the Tory Party, which was the national party of the national church and the party of empire. So we have, it seems, during that period, a kind of politics based not on perceptions of class so much, but on sectarian loyalties, religious identities, ethnic hostility, exemplified in this very strange politics that you get in Liverpool in the years before the First World War, where people like Pastor George Wise, a famous local figure in the 10 years or so before the First World War, and to some extent afterwards, organised these enormous orange demonstrations, you know, proclaiming loyalty to the King and the Union. And remember, the Conservative Party was known also as the Unionist Party. And engaging in street fights of a very brutal kind, often with Irish counter-demonstrations. It was all a bit like Belfast, really, rather than mainland Britain. So there you see there's an opportunity to understand political life in terms of what at first sight might appear to be non-political organisations, voluntary associations, church-based organisations particularly, but also sports clubs and organisations of that kind. After the First World War, with that massive extension of the franchise following the Fourth Reform Act of 1918, it's less easy to describe Lancashire politics in this kind of way. And it seems to me there's much more of a focus on class interests and class identities. And this has quite a lot to do with women coming into the electorate and what some people have described as the feminisation of politics. And it's this interwar period where what I've described as a new Toryism, taking an idea from Peter Clarke's old notion of new liberalism. You remember that book which came out when I was a young man, 1971, I think. I've described this interwar period development as a period of new Toryism. So what's it all about? And this is what the research is trying to delve into.
It's upside down.
There's a bit of a debate on this, actually, which always helps, doesn't it, to orientate your research. And my main inspiration, if inspiration it is from Ross McKibben, who Diane mentioned right at the beginning of today. In two fairly recent works, particularly Partisan People, which came out quite recently. Now, McKibben is trying to explain, he doesn't call it new Toryism, but he's trying to explain this phenomenon in more general terms in the 1920s and 30s, and puts a lot of emphasis on a process that he describes as colonising the voluntary associations. Throughout the 30s, the Conservatives further entrenched themselves within English life by informally colonising its rapidly developing associational life. Somehow or another, a Conservative Party captured the mentalities of people who formed part of organisations like the Women's Institute and the British Legion, the Ratepayers Association, and a vast array of different kinds of bowling and cricket and football clubs and that kind of thing, colonising the voluntary associations. The problem with McKibben's work is that it's kind of persuasive without being totally convincing. He hasn't got a lot of empirical evidence. He hasn't really interrogated the grassroots to make these kinds of statements and claims. I think he relies quite a lot on work that his PhD students have done, but some of which haven't been published. There's one very important PhD thesis by Jonathan Bates, one of McKibben's students, Oxford PhD of about 1993, which looked at the West Midlands, including the sort of more rural areas of Shropshire. Very, very good piece of work and provides something of a model as to how to make this link between voluntarism and politics, associational life and political mentalities. But otherwise, McKibben ain't got much, really. And I think his other main model is a piece of work that was done, you know this, it's very famous, Margaret Stacey, Tradition and Change, a Study of Banbury, which she did, you know, in the 1950s, but which was an ethnographic study of living people. You know, historians can't do this very easily because all the people from the 1920s are now well and truly gone. But McKibben, I think, derives quite a lot of his ideas from Stacey. But he does say that you know, his work is interpretational. It's not empirical. And I think he expects people, if they come up with the evidence, so to speak, to disagree with him. And Helen McCarthy is one person who has disagreed with him. A very impressive article here in Historical Journal. Sorry, Sam, can you see this?
Okay, yeah.
Who takes issue with McKibben. This is before Partisan People. Partisan People is his Ford Lectures in Oxford. It came out in 2010. McCarthy is thinking about previous work that McKibben has done, Classes and Cultures and other articles. And she's looked at a number of voluntary associations. The British Legion is one, Women's Institute is another, at both national and to some extent local levels, and disputes what McKibben is saying, suggesting that that these kinds of voluntary associations weren't political at all. They tried as far as possible to be non-partisan, which in some instances made them quite anti-conservative. But I don't think that's quite what McKibben was actually saying. So I'm not going to be put off pursuing the McKibben line just yet. So how have I been trying to do it? This is where I need your advice. I've taken it right down to the grassroots level, and I've been spending a lot of summer holidays looking through local constituency party records in the Northwest to see if they produce any answers or insights into this question. And you might say, well, that was a bloody stupid place to start to begin with, because actually they've not been terribly revealing about the problem that I had in mind. But I mean, this is historical research, isn't it? It's trial and error. You try things out, it doesn't work, you try something else. What have I looked at? Well, five case studies, actually, of the Northwest, which selected themselves because they were the only five areas of the Northwest for which I could find extant Conservative Party records, documents. They are Waterloo, which is a middle-class suburb, Tory stronghold abutting Liverpool. Fylde, which was another Tory stronghold, largely rural constituency dominated by the Stanleys, the Earls of Derby family. A bit of fishing at Fleetwood gave it a slightly industrial element, but essentially a rock-solid Tory seat. Both of those records in the Lancashire Record Office. Accrington, engineering, mining, textiles, mixed constituency industrially, and also mixed electorally in the interwar years. None of the three main parties could be sure of winning Accrington. Clitheroe, up in the northeast, interesting constituency. In the interwar years, largely, apart from a bit of textile manufacturing in Clitheroe itself, largely an agrarian seat and therefore pretty solidly Tory, except, funnily enough, in the first election of 1918 when Labour won it. And then you might remember that Clitheroe, as it had been before 1918, was the first seat won by Labour in Lancashire. 1902, David Shackleton. And the Labour vote was essentially in Nelson and Colne. But Nelson and Colne were detached in 1918 to form their own constituency, leaving Clitheroe as fairly clear territory for the Tories. And the fifth area was Bolton. Interesting double member seat. There were four of these in Lancashire which had been retained from the pre-war years, and Bolton was one of them. Much more of an industrial town, textiles, engineering, bit of mining. Should have been Labour by rights in the interwar period, but, you know, the Labour performance in the interwar years in this region was pretty pathetic, both at parliamentary level and also at local level. You know, read Sam Davis and Bob, what's his name, from John Moores's massive study of borough politics in the interwar period. Labour didn't do half as well as they ought to have done. So we've got, you know, a county which, in spite of the extension of the franchise in 1918, and in spite of the fact that many Tories in 1918 were very fearful about their prospects in the forthcoming years because of the expansion of the franchise, actually cemented their hegemony during these years. 62 constituencies in Lancashire in the 20s and 30s, returning 66 MPs. That's the four double-member constituencies taken care of. Of these, 35 seats were won more often than not by the Conservatives, for whom 15 borough and 7 county seats might be accounted safe. Four of these were in Liverpool. Two, Bury and Fylde, were even held in the Labour landslide of 1945. By contrast, the Labour Party might normally have expected to win 7 borough seats and 4 county divisions, but only 3 constituencies, Wigan, Ince and West Horton, all mining areas, were retained by Labour. Only 3 were retained by Labour at every election in the interwar period. So Conservative hegemony is an established fact. And I wanted to find out if the constituency records gave me any inkling about how this might be and whether it held up anything that that McKibben was suggesting.
Oh, 2 minutes, Joe.
2 minutes, right. It did produce some very interesting material. I gave the impression earlier that it was all rather negative. It wasn't. Some very interesting stuff about leisure taking place within the confines of the party itself. A lot of leisure activities sponsored by the Conservatives, which of course created a sense of Conservative sociability and Conservative loyalty. Women and youth come out of this extremely prominently, particularly women. The Conservative Party in the interwar years relied immensely on women working for it to produce the votes at the end of the day and to organise a lot of the leisure activities. They really are important, I think. And it owes something to the existence prior to the war of the Primrose League, which was a cultural organisation. It wasn't formally part of the Tory party, but it was very closely connected to it, and it stimulated values about empire and domesticity that were very close to the heart of Toryism itself. And noticeably, after the war, when the Tory party began itself to develop within its organisation this kind of cultural approach, the Primrose League kind of faded away, as if it had done its job, it had oiled the wheels of the Tory party to go in this direction. And what also comes out very clearly from looking at the sources is, you know, there is a very marked political context in which all this activity is taking place. And in particularly the 1920s, and especially in that difficult period of turmoil between 1919 and 1926, it was a very anti-socialist, anti-labour, anti-Bolshevik mentality that the Conservative Party was generating. And I think that's an indication of what McKibben is getting at, you know, that the voluntary associations might have assisted the Tories in maintaining this attitude of, you know, we are the mainstream, we are normal people, we are civilised society, we are the upholders of the Constitution, against all these other people, these outsiders who call themselves socialists and Bolsheviks and whatever have you, trade unionists even, who are doing their best to undermine the British system as we know it. Finally, what is to be done, if you'll forgive the Leninist implication in that subtitle? Well, widen the range of sources and explore some of these other areas. Although some of them are not going to be very useful, very little in the way of memoirs, oral history, I don't know, I've not explored it yet. Club records, from what David has been saying, might be the key area. So we won't be getting along to the record office and having a look at what you've got, I think, on this. Sports clubs are very important, it seems to me. Rugby, tennis and golf were, as perhaps you might imagine, they're often very suburban sports. We heard about them from Julie earlier on. Secondary agents of Toryism, they might be described as. That's a phrase from McKibben, incidentally. Richard Holt's History of Stanmore Golf Club, superseded now, I've heard Julie talking about golf in Hertfordshire, is a good example. More interesting for what it doesn't say than what it does, I think. And so finally, the aim is to try and bring sport and leisure out of its sort of ghetto of just being about sport and leisure and try and move it more directly into the mainstream of the history of civil society. That's me. Sorry, I'm
No, you're okay. Thanks, Roger. Okay, questions, observations, help, assistance? Mike?
You raised some really interesting questions there, Dave.
Yes, answers I want. Make answers, please.
I'm thinking about this too. I think I remember reading John Walton's book on Lancashire, and he talks a bit about, you know, the Tories in Lancashire. Mm. It seems to me that what's happening is that conservatism is looking for support on several different fronts simultaneously and in different ways. At least that's my impression. And in a sense, when you couch the questions at the start, who do they vote for? What do they vote for and who do they vote with? The other question, of course, as you indicate, is who do they vote against and what do they vote against?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really, in part, that's a really critical question. If you look, for example, in terms of gender, on the one hand, you've got Israel's Primrose League, which gets a lot of support from women. And they have one set of, and quite often the women who join this, you know, when you look at them, they have one set of agendas, which is much more about status and, you know, respectability, you know, and all that sort of thing. On the other hand, if you look at the Brewers are very organised, and given that they've got managers in Liverpool, they've got the tenants in all the major Brewers have loads of pub tenants, and they can get a lot of support through that sort of organisation, and quite often, as soon as the Liberals, for example, start to go on things like, you know, the banning of drink, they start to lose elections. Mm. And they lose elections because people are voting against that.
Mm.
You know, and you can see that in places like Lancashire, when they tried to ban the races, you know, the Liberals are voted out. And you can see that elsewhere as well. So there are different things happening with different, in a sense, in marketing terms, the Conservatives are marketing different groups in different ways simultaneously. Mm. Just as today, with slightly different political messages, I suspect. Mm. And so I guess I'm wondering if one thing to do is to start looking at those different markets and those different audiences again. You know, for example, the sort of Brewers Press might have one set of, you know, messages about why you should vote Tory, Conservative.
Mm.
On the other hand, if you're looking at women, particularly those members of the Primrose League, that's a quite different message. And those women may not be the wives of the men who are voting Conservative on the other way. I think it needs to be brought. At the moment, it's, you know, I can see how you're moving forward and what you're looking at. And the next stage, I think, is to start breaking it down more.
Yeah.
That's a completely off the top of my head view.
No, that's interesting.
So for example, in some rural areas, the sort of survival of influence and paternalism may have a message in some rural areas, which it wouldn't at all.
Mm. Yeah.
If you're looking at that. So,
yes,
so
yeah,
I think,
right.
I think mm. I'd want, if I was doing it, moving on from where you are now, I think I'd want to start breaking that down.
Mm. You're right. You've got to be careful you don't rule out issues altogether.
Right? Right.
There are important issues, and you can make this almost into a sort of non-political attitude, can't you? And there's a difference between a middle-class seat like Waterloo, which is Villa Toryism, very middle class, and farmers in the Fylde,
yeah,
you know, who are motivated by different things. So, yeah, that's good. I'm glad you've... Yeah, thank you, Mike.
Can I first of all say something I was going to say when I do my bit, and that is that when looking at this, the list of topics for today, they look as though they're completely self-standing and totally unrelated. And having listened to them all, it's amazing how many connections there are.
It's Dave, he's a genius, he saw all this.
and the connections with what I will be hopefully saying towards the end. But that links me on to a couple of questions, if you like, or points out. I'm sure this is a book I bought just a few days ago, and I'm sure you've probably looked at it. It's called The Ages of Voluntarism.
Right, I don't know this.
And it's edited by Matthew Hilton and James Mackay.
Oh,
it
yes.
has a chapter by...
Where are they from?
Sorry?
Yeah. Where are they from?
Well, Hilton's at Birmingham.
It's actually got a chapter by Helen McCarthy in it.
Yeah.
But it leads me on to the... Because this is an issue I've been looking at in connection with the two organisations that I'm researching. But it's been said to me that, for instance, most of the voluntary organisations in the late 19th and early 20th centuries were affiliated to the National Council of Social Service, for instance. And one of the conditions of being affiliated to the National Council of Social Service was no political affiliation. Now, how does that square up? I don't know.
I'm sure a lot of people who are members of voluntary associations in the constituencies would say, we're not political. We're Tories.
Yes.
And that's the trick of Toryism in this period. It's somehow managed to get that over, this kind of middle groundness that they... Yeah.
I was just wondering about how you map all these associations, you know, all these different groups, to kind of dig down and, because we're talking about quite a range of different groups, but in a particular community, you're going to have a number of different types, aren't you? And I'm kind of doing that in-depth work to see who belongs and where they, you know, that kind of mapping and networking.
Because it is, it's about the creation of social networks, which is what Diane mentioned this morning.
That kind of research, I think, too.
One method I tried, I didn't mention this, was to look at obituaries of leading Conservatives and see who turned up at the funeral. And I did one in particular for a woman who'd been very prominent in Waterloo politics. She was mayor of Crosby just after the war. When she died in the 1960s, all sorts of representatives from this, that and the other organisation turned up at the church to pay their respects. And I thought, well, that might be a route to follow.
I think that would actually be a really rich source, especially if you could put it on a database of some sort so it could kind of deal with those cross-connections.
Thank you.
It also tends to list their affiliations, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Member of this lodge
chairman
of this club and that kind of stuff. So you've got those kind of networks building there.
Sounds like a primitive sort of form of like prosopography in that kind of sense.
Yes, it is in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, primitive. Definitely describes my work.
Anything else for Jeff? Thank you very much.
Thanks, folks.